Hello, and thank you for attending today's webinar, Point of Sale and Credit Card Transaction Security for Embedded Systems, Critical Compliance and Threat Mitigation Techniques and Solutions. I'm Kurt Schwader, your moderator, with today's speakers Gina Tamo from Avnet Embedded, Casey Beams from Foundstone, and John McMahon from McAfee. Today's schedule consists of about 50 minutes of presentation, leaving 10 minutes at the end of the hour for audience Q&A. Before we begin, I'd like to run down some features of your viewing console. If you've attended previous OSM webinars, you'll notice a different layout and operation, so please follow along. At the bottom of your audience console are multiple application widgets. Each of these widgets will bring up a separate window within your viewing console. Now, each window can be resized by clicking and dragging the lower right-hand corner of the window, or maximized and minimized using the icons at the upper right-hand corner. The slides window contains material that's being presented. The media player window allows you to volume adjust. The Q&A window allows you to participate in today's event. You can simply type a question into the text box and submit it by clicking the submit button. You can submit questions at any time. We encourage you to do so early and often while the material is in front of you and the question is fresh in your mind. We'll address as many of these as time allows, and you can submit questions about the ECAST operation itself too, and one of our technicians will be happy to help. The resources window contains today's slide set in PDF format and some downloaded supplemental materials for your information. The help window will take you to an event help guide page, and the speaker bio window provides background information on today's presenters. We also have an interactive poll question in today's event. When you see that poll pop up on your screen, you select the button next to the answer and click the submit button. There will also be a closing survey after the Q&A. We ask that you please take the time to fill this out as well. It's very important feedback, and it's your opportunity to help drive innovation for point-of-sale systems. An on-demand version of this webcast will also be made available approximately one day after the webcast. It can also be accessed using the same audience link as it was sent to you earlier via email. Gina Tamo will be kicking things off today. Gina is a supplier business manager with Avnet Embedded. She has been at Avnet since 1999 and started as a material analyst for the Motorola program. Gina spent 8 years on Avnet Display Solution team managing supplier relationships, training, and marketing activities. She became part of Avnet Embedded Software and Services team in 2012, and her responsibilities of being a supplier business manager for Red Hat, Wind River, and McAfee, including marketing, business development, demand generation, training, readiness, and overarching awareness activities. Gina, the floor is yours.
Good morning. As Kurt said, my name is Gina Tamo, and I am the supplier business manager responsible for the relationship between Avnet Embedded and McAfee Intel Security. At the end of the presentation, I would like to briefly explain Avnet Embedded. McAfee is an Intel company and Avnet's partner in providing customer solutions, embedded customers with industry-leading security and compliance software solutions. Today's key takeaways are that there's a shared responsibility for retail PCI compliance. The device manufacturers have a responsibility to help their end customers. PCI compliance requirements have changed, and McAfee Embedded offers the most comprehensive solution to help your customers comply. And lastly, with the onslaught of targeted attacks, doing nothing is simply no longer an option. Casey Beams is a 20-plus year information technology veteran and active information security practitioner since 1992. Casey has been consulting for over 15 years. As a technical practice director at Soundstone, Casey is responsible for strategic consulting services lines, including security program assessment, development, security governance, risk and compliance services, and business continuity, as well as disaster recovery services. Casey also has the HR responsibilities for the Soundstone consultants delivering these services. Joe McMahon is an enterprise solution architect at McAfee. Joe has over 18 years of information systems experience, including more than 10 years in information security. He specializes in endpoint security, virtualization, and compliance. Joe earned his BBA in CIS Finance from Eastern Michigan University in Ypsilanti, Michigan. On your screen, you see a poll question. Please answer the question now. I'd like to hand it over to Casey. Casey Beans.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. So what I would like to do is talk a little bit about some of our recent breaches. We're not going to go into the specific details. Of course, you can find out lots of that in line, but there were some commonalities that are important to understand. So what I'd like to do is have you imagine a timeline, and this timeline would be the timeline during which the attack occurs, and data begins to be stolen. Data is going to continue to be lost at a rapid pace until the discovery of the breach, and then it'll continue until the mitigation can be put into place. Of course, computer networks are fast, and quite a lot of data can be lost in a week. If you see some of these timelines here, these different breaches, you can see that there's a significant window of opportunity for lost records. The point-of-sale breaches involved, in many of these cases, an exploited external web application from which an attacker pivoted to other systems to plant malware. The malware then operated with command and control, and data was exfiltrated through an overly permissive firewall rule set. These breaches, the customers that were harmed, and the lawsuits that will continue in these cases could have all been avoided through rational security planning and execution. Another thing that's becoming really popular is ATM skimming. It's an ongoing issue of not giving credit to the creativity of the attackers and also not being willing to address the known threats and alter the environments to protect against these threats. With tens of thousands of ATMs under an organization's management, it makes sense on one hand, but at what impact? So these breaches had a number of lessons learned. Through our assessments that we do out with customers, we see that the old paradigm of that hard external perimeter and that soft, squishy internal is still alive. The Department of Defense in the U.S. certainly has its challenge with compartmentalized networks, but it should be thought of as a viable and inexpensive method to keep higher criticality environments much more protected. We do this in real life with concerts, movie sets, physical security at our buildings in certain areas. Why would we not do this with our network and our data as well? So we recommend using segmentation and monitoring or logging to ensure that systems and people are where they should be doing what they should be doing. Most organizations have layer 2 and layer 3 segmentation capabilities. It doesn't require full firewall features within a cardholder data environment and in the internal network, but it does require a consensus within the organization that it should be done and then decide who should be responsible for doing it. Like you see that layer 2 or layer 3 filter sets may be controlled by the network team, or firewalls are the domain of the firewall team, or anything that filters should be the firewall team, or things like that. Bridging those gaps for the sake of security, of rational security, is really where we want to be. So it takes a bit of prior planning, and retrofitting existing environments can be challenging, but this should be the status quo in payment and high-value environments going forward. So PCI, as a standard, it has a lot of complex terms. And with any compliance standard, of course, the devil is in the details. The words that are used and the meaning interpreted can have vast effects on how compliance is implemented and measured. Certainly, QSAs have their challenges in understanding an environment and interpreting the PCI compliance requirements. So it's important to understand what some of these terms mean and what the scope of, say, the point-of-sale application is, what a payment application, DSS validated application is, what the point of interaction scope is, if you will. All of these are really important terms, and it's really good to have these documents close at hand and have read through them thoroughly to understand what your minimum baseline requirements are. So what is in scope? The PCI and DSS security requirements apply to all system components included in or connected to the cardholder data environment. Cardholder data environment is comprised of people, processes, and technologies that store, process, or transmit cardholder data or sensitive authentication data. So if you refer to page 10 of the PCI DSS, you'll see a definition of what is in scope. Something to note, though, when they say can reach systems that touch card data, it's a bit ambiguous. What it really means is that a system can make an IP connection to the in-scope system. That's what they're focusing on. And if a firewall or a boundary system access list is not configured correctly, then that segmentation could be disproved, and then the scope could extend to systems in other parts of the network. And, you know, certainly there are challenges where there is no segmentation and you have a flat network. And if you can imagine the scale of some of those recent breaches, Neiman Marcus and Target having such a huge footprint across the U.S. anyway. So understanding that network footprint is essential in determining what is in or what is not in scope. For embedded systems that serve as point of interaction solutions, either standalone or part of an application solution provided to a merchant, there may be requirements to undergo validation under the payment application DSS or point of interaction security requirements. The point of interaction validation is required for the device to appear on the PCI's list of approved, the PCI Council list of approved devices. Visa requires that new purchases of PIN entry devices be devices that are on this list, and that those older devices that merchants usually get from their banks, their acquirers, they require that those older ones be sunsetted. Right now, there is no real method for QSAs to report on the use of non-approved devices. It's not part of the assessment protocol, which presents some significant challenges in ensuring overall security. Each card brand has its set of requirements that the acquirers are supposed to enforce, but it's fairly muddy, and it doesn't appear to be in the current merchant agreement contracts that a merchant may have with a bank that's doing their acquiring. So where does that leave a manufacturer? You have to know what the exposure is in your device. If you use the Windows embedded and you are using, you know, it being fully featured or even partially featured, you should know and consider that you are currently a target. Even though the point of action interaction requirements require you to enable only those features that are required for the system, it's still a platform that has been scrutinized to a high degree, and there are a lot of vulnerabilities. We recommend that you leverage best practices such as the PCI DSS, payment application DSS, and the point of interaction security requirements from the council to help you make a better, more secure system. If you demonstrate that due diligence, your liability, if you should happen to incur any, may be reduced, and you'll have a much better value statement for your customers and your customers' customers. When we look into the healthcare industry, the spotlight right now is on medical device manufacturers as well as medical organizations. The FDA says take steps to assure that appropriate safeguards are in place to reduce the risk. So as government becomes much more familiar with the issues at hand and with incidents that occur, you can expect that a lot of this may come down onto merchants, manufacturers, acquirers, and even QSAs, you know, to ensure that everything is working in compliance and working securely. So if we go back to retail, we've seen the recent breaches leverage malware to take advantage of unencrypted sensitive data in memory and exfiltrate that data. The PCI DSS is fairly weak in requirement 6.5, which requires understanding how sensitive data is handled in memory. We recommend that a threat analysis study be included as part of the system's development lifecycle. The embedded devices that you're using or that you're building, odds are you're using a lot of the same core operating systems as regular PCs and servers, and a lot of them have been demonstrated to be at risk. So while we don't intend to go over all the changes in the DSS, we want to discuss some key aspects. Overall, there is a significant amount of documentation required throughout the PCI DSS. The more diligent that the documentation is, the more organized you'll appear to any assessor, any QSA, and the confidence factor ends up going up. The DSS documentation is not standalone. You know, you've got to have inputs from executive management for that business strategy, enterprise risk management, IT service management. And then if you have any service providers as a merchant that do work for you, a lot of that has to be documented. In 2.0, systems not commonly affected by viruses like Unix systems, Macs, and mobile devices could be excluded from having AV software. In requirement 5.1.2 in the new DSS version 3, it requires a process be in place that periodically reevaluates that choice of not having AV or some sort of a safeguard against malware. An understanding of the threat landscape is going to be important. Others to mention here. Requirement 9.9 is a new requirement, but it won't be required to be enforced until July 1st, 2015. And it's to have the merchants physically inspect the point of interaction devices that capture the payment card data. And for large organizations, this responsibility could fall onto store managers and team members with whatever they find reported up to central IT security or the compliance function. So that process documentation really needs to be very clear and education taken very seriously to ensure that an organization covers this space. Probably one of the more significant changes that goes into a different group that you would commonly see. And that pretty much covers that slide. In requirement 10 is a lot about logging. And many of the organizations that we've worked with have been kind of at a loss as to what it is that they're looking for in the log. So while it talks about you have to review them on a daily basis and follow up on exceptions, well, what are you looking for? What are those exceptions? What do you need to do on those exceptions? So with the volume of events that are coming through into the STEM, what would be suspicious? Additional tools and training are really needed to strengthen the capabilities of the administrators and to create and implement. And we recommend that, you know, certain use cases be created and implemented based on common or current attack techniques that could involve correlation of certain events from multiple systems in multiple parts of the environment. So that centralization of that log data is really important. And we'll move on to the next slide. Compensating controls. What can you use where? Compensating controls need to have a legitimate technological or documented business constraint. Previous statements from the council have indicated that an extremely high cost for a particular solution set is a good enough justification. Technology that doesn't support the requested or the required feature is also a good justification for a compensating control. Merchants really, they have to do something. You can't just do nothing. A compensating control isn't a feature that you could say, let's just acknowledge this risk and do something about it at a later date. You have to do something. Many of the compensating controls, the controls that you put in instead of the real control, will involve increased logging and monitoring. And, you know, that processes, additional processes be performed. In general, the substituted controls, they have to meet or exceed the intent of the original control. A QSA is there to help the merchant document and validate the control, but it is really up to the acquirer, not the QSA, to accept it. And this has been a lot of confusion as well. Sometimes you get overbearing QSAs, and a merchant really has to have a good relationship with their acquirer to be able to keep that balance of power, if you will, in check. Application for whitelisting or AV replacement, yes. It must ensure that the entire executable space is locked down and monitored. BitLocker for file encryption, possibly, depending on how key management is performed. Without additional processes and technologies, BitLocker setup and management of keys is a one-person job, and thus doesn't meet the requirements. However, a merchant or service provider might be able to draft a compensated control for those aspects of key management that cannot be complied with due to the technical limitations of the product. BitLocker for disk encryption, no, not until it can use a second authentication mechanism that is separate from the operating system. And the same goes for Apple's File Vault technology. Linux encrypting file systems, though, could possibly meet this requirement because the access control to the encrypted space is different from the operating system access. So with regards to the Microsoft Security Essentials, now just called Windows Defender, it meets most of the PCI requirements out of the box. Some GPOs will have to be configured to establish logging, set up regular scanning, and prevent users from disabling it. File integrity monitoring in the version 3 parlance says change detection mechanism. It's the process of comparing a change or a file to a group of files from one time period to the next. PCI requires file comparisons to be performed no less than weekly. Real-time detection, though, is very reasonable depending on the technology in use. The Windows auditing environment is very robust. However, it lacks the ability to use a file comparison method to determine the change. It flags only the object access operation. If an organization can create a file comparison method through their own internal development combined with audit object access methods, this could be a viable solution, or you could, you know, implement a file integrity monitoring solution. So there's this concept of compliance drift. When over time a system or process it moves away from compliance, or at that exact point in time the environment is out of compliance because of some time-based activity like a weekly comparison of files that hasn't fired yet. It could be, you know, a vulnerability scan as well. When audits are performed at a point in time, oftentimes they're finding, while merchants sign contracts to say they will maintain compliance, QSAs only assess on an annual basis for level one merchants. Approved scanning vendors, ASVs, perform their duties on a quarterly basis. Or when significant changes occur. So there's room to be non-compliant when, you know, things aren't being looked at. So while compliance doesn't necessarily equal security, non-compliance is vulnerability that could be exploiting, leading to a breach, and that's what could be happening during those during that time of drifted compliance. So I invite you to consider a few questions based on the last audit, perhaps, of the merchant that you've had. What worked and what didn't work? How did compliance drift from the time period of the previous assessment to the current assessment? Did it take a long time to collect the right artifact and the right sample on the right sampled system? Did processes break down that caused findings? Was there a human element involved? Did misunderstandings of the requirement occur? What could be done to make the compliance assessment process less cumbersome, to cause less confusion, less asking business people and technical people artifacts that perhaps they don't quite understand very well as to how to get, what data can be collected in an automated fashion, what technologies can be implemented so that the configuration baseline can be implemented and then have assurance that the configuration didn't change, or if it did change, who changed it, when, how, and why. What if you could generate a compliance audit report for any sampled system, for any compliance requirement, for any compliance framework at any point in time, and know that you passed without finding it? It's certainly a laudable goal. It's a big goal, but it's possible. So with that, I would like to hand it over to Joe, who's going to give a little bit more information about the McAfee solution. Joe?
Thank you, Casey. It's really informative. So I'm just going to get started a little bit about from the McAfee side and how we deal with PCI DSS. We really have a proactive protection and visibility solution. From our perspective, our solution is really purposely built around store environments. We're really focused on security controls and reports dashboards for POS back office systems, as well as related in-store systems. Our solution really includes one of our product sets called McAfee Integrity Control, which provides security controls for demonstrating compliance with PCI sections 10.5.5, 11.5, which specify the file integrity monitoring part of PCI DSS. Also within there, we help address other sections within PCI, including 1, 2, 6, and 8. Many retail environments can't run anti-malware solutions on their store systems because of lack of resources. So this solution itself has a very low overhead, so it's a very nice fit for that type of environment. We can also act as a compensating control for these types of anti-malware solutions. So it's basically a proactive solution as opposed to a reactive solution, meaning that with a blacklisting solution such as an antivirus, it's dependent on having a DAT file brought down to the endpoint system where this is to actually mitigate all the issues or malware that are on the systems, whereas in a whitelisting solution, we're going to protect the integrity of the applications and memory space on that system without allowing any other outside influences to actually attack those executables and such. Also, we have within McAfee, we have a lot of partnerships within our organization. We call it the Strategic Innovation Alliance. Excuse me. With different log companies, so we can actually help you address other areas of the logging area of logging, as well as protecting the database systems and monitoring database environments as well. So where do we fit? So in PCI itself, one of the things that you have to do is you have to measure the end effect of the requirement, ensure that the substitute solution meets the intent and mitigates the risk as good or better as the original requirement. And Casey specified that during her presentation. One of the compensating controls, which I'm going to discuss, is application whitelisting for antivirus. And again, it's more of a proactive solution to protect POS terminals and devices from tampering or substitution. Our solution itself is a anti-malware and compliance for retail specifically. It is a dynamic whitelisting solution, and the reason we call it dynamic whitelisting is because we trust applications and trust sources to make changes to that whitelist. Only those types of trusted sources can actually alter the whitelist, in which case it will make it a very safe environment because we know what's being changed and what is changing the actual the applications on the system itself. With that, we also add in memory protection from the 32-bit and 64-bit perspective. So if something tries to attack the memory space with some type of buffer overflow attack, we're going to actually stop that right at the door. Again, one of the nice features of having whitelisting as opposed to a blacklisting solution is there's no updates or signatures required, meaning that we don't have to be dependent on a DAT file or a signature file on a daily basis to actually mitigate any of the malware that's out there. Also, with our solution, we actually do something called reputation-based file interrogation. What does that mean? That means we're going to take the whitelist, meaning that all the executables, scripts, drivers, DLLs, sys files, library files that reside out on that system, and we're going to take them and interrogate them with McAfee's Global Threat Intelligence Database. So we'll actually do a comparison of all the file hashes that are on that system and let you know if you have any malware residing out there, and then give you the ability to actually block access to that application and stop it from functioning. Another area where integrity control, our solution, will help fit the need in the PCI environment is for file integrity monitoring. We provide comprehensive change information, meaning that we will give you the who, what, when, where, and how anything changes out on that system, as well as having the ability to filter out unnecessary information, such as swap files and temp files and things of that nature. So getting you good information or fruitful information is one of our top priorities, to make sure that you're getting comprehensive information that you can, if you need to go out, if you need to be audited and I have to follow up with the audit with information, an audit trail, it gives you good information to go look at, not just a bunch of misleading information. On top of that, the last component of protection is protecting the configuration files. So we can actually take and protect the registry as well as text-based configuration files from tampering, meaning that if we have a configuration file that, such as some type of XML file or some type of INI or config file, we can actually read protect or write protect that, as well as write protect components of the registry. Now, all of this seems like it's going to take a lot of performance away from the system itself, and it could be and it would seem so, but actually it's a very lightweight solution, meaning that it only takes about 8 to 20 megabytes of memory, uses less than 1% of the CPU, and about physical disk space about less than 60 megabytes. So it's extremely lightweight comparatively to other security solutions that are out in the environment. So what do we cover? So from the POS perspective, we cover everything from Windows NT4 all the way out to the latest and greatest Windows 8.1 and 2012 server. Also the embedded operating systems, meaning that a lot of retailers out there still are running Windows XP embedded or POS ready. We actually will cover those types of operating systems as well, and we actually have a lot of customers running those operating systems. So we are a solution already in place in those types of environments. We, on top of the Microsoft environment, we also cover the Linux environment from the perspective of Red Hat, CentOS, SUSE, and now we just included Ubuntu into the environment, as well as Solaris 8, 9, and 10. So just a little bit about whitelisting. How does it work? Right, so normally on a system, you can go out and start applications within the antivirus, or go out and scan the system from an on-access side or an on-demand side, demand meaning that it will do a full scan. So whitelisting itself really focuses on allowing whatever's in the whitelist to continue to run and only allow trusted sources to make changes to those trusted applications that are out there. So when a user attempts to launch an application, essentially it will go out and check the whitelist. If it's in the whitelist, it will start. If it's not in the whitelist, it actually will be blocked. We also have an optional component that can pop up on the screen saying that it's a notification that would say something to the effect of that you're trying to start an application that is not currently in the whitelist. Please contact the help desk. Now, this is an optional control, and the reason we say it's an optional control because most POS environments really do not want pop-ups to come up on the screen because they don't have the ability to just miss them. So, from that perspective, this is an optional solution, but you could utilize this on the server environment for the back office. So one of the other protection methods that we use inside of the software is protecting the memory space itself. So we've got two different sides of techniques, so from 32-bit and 64-bit perspective. From the 32-bit side, we have something called critical address space protection, which is a memory control that was created by our McAfee engineers that will protect against buffer overflows, as well as our other part of our 32-bit memory protection called VASR, or variable address space randomization. From the 64-bit side, we do something called forced ASLR, which is our version of ASLR, and color context validation. These are different ways that we're protecting the 32 and 64-bit operating systems. So now, really, how does it work? If something's in the whitelist on the system, it's allowed to occupy the memory space. If it's not in the whitelist, it will be not allowed to actually make its way into the memory space. So any type of buffer overflow attack or any other type of malware push-throughs, we're actually going to stop those right at the door. All right, how do we provision this? So we've got a couple different methods of provisioning it. One is from our ePolicy Orchestrator server, or our centralized server. It is McAfee's flagship server. It will actually support up to 150,000 endpoints. And we have the ability to do deployments from this server, as well as manage and create some metrics from it. So from the perspective of integrity control, the way that we provision it is we would it's essentially two tasks that are going to make its way down to the endpoint system from the server. One is going to create the inventory and enable that software. And then basically the next mode that it's going to go into is going to be called production mode. And from production mode, we actually will specify or define our trusted sources that make changes. Now, the one thing that also happens is when we provision this, it's going to be software is going to make its way down. We're going to engage the protection, and then a one-time reboot needs to take place because we're actually going to reboot the system to hook into the memory space itself. Now, from the other side of it, if it's an environment that is more of an air-gapped environment and we don't have the ability to have a server in the environment, we can also put it in a standalone fashion. And the way that we deploy it that way is basically from an installer or a scripted installer. We will, again, engage the protection by enabling it. Then we have this whitelisted inventory, and then we would specify just via the command line with a couple different commands on what's going to be a trusted source of change. Only real difference between the two is, you know, this one's done via scripting and done via command line, where the from the server perspective, we're provisioning from the server side itself and sending out this the software from there and actually managing the policy from the server side. So after it's provisioned, we're going to be in this trusted mode, and you know we have to allow some types of changes to take place to the system. So how do we do that? We've got different software update methods, and they include the ones that I have up on the screen right now, starting with authorized administrators. And what does that mean? So it means that if I log into the system as an authorized administrator, I'm allowed to add and remove software from the system and make changes. Everything that I do is going to be actually logged. So if I add a piece of software or if I remove a piece of software, it's actually going to be logged up on the server itself or logged in a file. And we'll have the ability to go back and look at an audit trail of any types of changes that take place. But from the perspective of being an authorized administrator, I can actually install and remove software from the system with my user ID. It actually will integrate with Active Directory, so I can actually do groups as well as specific users. Probably the most common way that we allow changes to take place are from a third-party software update service, such as a Tivoli or an SCCM or an Alteris. Now, how does that work? So basically, if I send down a software update from SCCM saying I want to install a package down in the endpoint system, it's going to actually go down to the system, and there's going to be a client component called ccmexec.exe. ccmexec.exe is in the whitelist already, so it's already being protected, but we're going to elevate that executable's privilege, saying that it can actually install things down to the endpoint systems. So really there's no interaction on the SCCM side. As long as we have it defined as an updating mechanism, it should be a seamless update system. Another way is that we allow changes to take place are from authorized directories and shares, meaning that if I define a directory or a share out in the network, I can allow installs to take place. Also, you can sign your own software, meaning that if you have a digital signature, you can sign your own software. If it matches the digital signature, it will be allowed to be installed on the endpoint. We can do something called a time-based update, meaning with the change management environments, we can open a change window and close a change window in an automatic fashion. So we could say, you're going to start your updating at 3 o'clock and close it off at 9 o'clock in the evening, so I can open a window up and allow you to make software changes to the system. As you're doing that, everything is going to be logged to the server, so we will have at least a record of everything that is changing on that system itself. Lastly, another way that we allow changes is through SHA-1, meaning that if I register a SHA-1 on the system, meaning that if it matches the hash, let's say setup.exe has a specific SHA-1.hash, I can allow that to be installed on the endpoint system. One thing to note about this, of all these different methods that are out there, you still have to have administrative permissions within the operating system. So if you're a domain admin, or you have administrative privileges, yes, you can install things on the endpoint, but you do have to have authorized administrator privileges from our perspective. And it goes the other way as well. Just because you're an authorized administrator within our software doesn't mean you're an authorized administrator within the Windows operating system. So we write in parallel, so it's a double protection method, which is it's a really nice thing to have, having both sides of it. One of the other benefits of whitelisting is we can take the whitelist off each system and we can do some interrogation to it, meaning that I can actually take every executable script driver, DLL, that's out there and bring it out to McAfee's Global Threat Intelligence Cloud, where we have a global blacklist and we also have a global whitelist. What happens is we assign a trust score to those binaries that reside on in your system. And the binaries go from 1 through 5, 1 and 2 being known malware, 3 being an unknown piece of software, 4 and 5 being known good pieces of software. What happens at this point is we have an inventory, and what it looks like from our perspective on the server is we have known goods, known bads, and then we have something called the gray list, which is really just unknowns. And unknown could be something along the way that it was a custom-built piece of software for your environment. For example, when we install the McAfee agent, it is custom on every environment. So it would be an unknown piece of software because we actually write the executable on the fly, and it will install our McAfee agent, meaning our communication agent, for each specific environment. So it is generated from our server. So it would be considered a gray list or an unknown because it is a brand-new generated hash in the environment. Same goes with other custom POS softwares. We're not going to know about this, but you actually will know about it in your environment. So you can basically approve it inside of your file reputation. So again, it's going to be known goods and known bads. The known goods are 4s and 5s from our trust score. Known bads are 1s and 2s. Now, since we do have an inventory on every system, and again, they are assigned through our global threat intelligence, we're going to have a trust score assigned to every one of those binaries that reside on the system. And within that, you have the ability to look at the applications that you have installed on each system, as well as having the ability to block those applications, meaning that you could potentially, if somebody has iTunes on a system, you can actually ban that application from running on the endpoint. One of the other nice benefits of having a whitelisted system is having the ability to do something called image deviation. And what this does for you is gives you the ability to standardize your systems. So you could take one system, you could designate it your gold POS system, and at that point you can do a comparison to the other POS systems in the environment, meaning that you could potentially take that system and look at, from the other systems that are out there, has anybody added files to it? Has anybody modified files? Are there things missing from that? So really want to keep the consistency of what's out in the environment and find out if there's any mismatches and such. So really it will keep from any downtime. All right, on top of that, we do something called configuration file protection. So we will read, protect, and write, protect configuration files, and they're text-based files itself. Why would I want to read protect the file? If I read protect the file, the human eye can't take it, can't copy it off this, can't see it, and it can't be copied off the system. As well as if I write protect the file, it can't be modified. As well as write protect components of the registry. One of the other things that we do as far as meeting PCI requirements is doing some comprehensive file integrity monitoring, meaning that we will monitor all types of changes for who, what, when, where, and how, and take those changes that are out there and do some filtering also to remove all the unnecessary types of changes that are out there that are made by common system daily events or things that are just swap files and temp files and things of that nature. We'll filter out that information itself just so we can give you good information as well as easy to go out and audit this information. So in detail, one of the things that we'll see on a system is the who, what, when, where, and how. And here's an example of a file change detail. And from the who perspective, it is, you know, who made this change on the system, from what domain, where the change was made, on what system it was, how it was done. So this example, was we're using notepad.exe, modified the INI file, and, you know, the result of it was it was modified itself, and then we have a timestamp on exactly when this was done. So you're receiving the who, what, when, where, and how, which is what an auditor would like to see from an audit trail perspective. So other things that are included inside of the software is customizable dashboards and queries. Within our dashboards, they are fully actionable, meaning that you can drill down into each one of these areas and find out, you know, which files have been modified. Every one of these components inside of here can be, you can drill down, look deeper into those, and do some further investigation on those. These reports also can be emailed to you, or they're easily created on the fly also. So we have a report wizard built into it and a query wizard built into the ePolicy Orchestrator server that's very user-friendly and very easy to work with. All right, just a quick summary of our solution itself for the POS environment. And again, the solution is called McAfee Integrity Control. It provides a dynamic whitelisting solution, meaning that it prevents all unauthorized code from running on the system, only allows your authorized code to run on there. We protect the memory space from buffer overflow attacks with our memory protection, from a 32-bit and 64-bit memory protection. We take that whitelist itself and we do some file reputation for you, and we integrate with our global threat intelligence to classify those binaries as good, bads, and unknowns, as well as doing some comprehensive file integrity monitoring, meaning giving you a detailed file change, giving you detailed file change information based on PCI regulations. Having the ability to also protect your configuration files on your system will help you lock it up even further. And lastly, having some, you know, common reports that are built into it for PCI and queries out of the box, as well as giving you the ability with a report wizard to create your own types of reports and have them, you know, be easily viewed and as well as forwarded off for emailing. All right, so with that, I will turn it back over being turned back over to, I believe, Christine.
With Gina. So I just wanted to give you guys an update on Avnet Embedded. With the proliferation of the Internet of Things and intelligent systems, there's going to be over 20 billion endpoint devices out there. Each one of those devices allows an entry into that intelligent system. So we need to keep that in mind whenever we're building these intelligent systems. And, you know, Avnet Embedded, it can be your trusted partner for McAfee security solutions and help you navigate the Internet of Things. So I'll turn it back over to Kurt.
Great. Thank you very much. We are now to the Q&A portion. Again, we encourage you to keep asking those questions. Let's start with a question for Casey. There's a question regarding any sort of material or places they can go or information to support the issue between correlation of documentation and security. Are there any places or hard numbers that you can go find to support that?
Correlation of documentation and security. I'm not quite understand what the question.
In general, it means the more documentation of the processes, the higher the security, reliability and security was, I think.
Right. So basically this takes the premise of, if you think about a process and you document a process hard enough, you'll be familiar enough with the process to deliver it more consistently over time. Mm-hmm. Though, you know, let's not kid ourselves. Once a process is documented and people get it, then they're going to do whatever they want, you know, over time.
Right.
You know, so whatever you can do to automate a workflow, you know, in that process, the better. Really, the documentation is important for an external auditor to understand as quickly as possible, which in turn saves the merchant's money, to understand as quickly as possible what it is that gets performed, and that there has been some thought put to it. And then we can compare from what is written in the documentation to what we hear that the people performing the process actually say that they do, and then what we see on the systems that we would expect to see based on the statements from the people and what is written in the documentation.
Okay, I see. Joe, there's a question about what operating systems are supported for typical, you know, point-of-sale environments and how the solution fits together.
Sure, that's a great question. So from our perspective, we cover everything from the Windows environment, meaning from Windows NT4 all the way out to the new latest and greatest 8.1 in Windows 12, 2012 servers. But really specifically for the POS side, most POS environments are, you know, really using the Windows XP environment that I see from day-to-day operations. I see it mostly, I'd say 80% of my clients are still running Windows XP or Windows XP embedded or Windows Pause ready. We support all the embedded operating systems that are out there, as well as the regular workstation operating systems from a Windows perspective. If you're in the Linux environment, we support Red Hat, SUSE, Ubuntu, as well as CentOS in those different types of environments. And probably the least seen out in the environments anymore is from whitelisting, we'll support the Solaris environment. But again, I'm seeing that kind of fade away into the sunset over time, where it's being really predominantly Windows as well as Linux.
Okay. But there's a question about dynamic whitelisting as well. Will dynamic whitelisting impact the performance of my device? If not, why not?
So that's a great question. So dynamic whitelisting is really a great fit for the POS environment because of its limited resource utilization, meaning that it's very lightweight. It uses less than 1% of the CPU, about 8 to 20 megabytes of memory out there. So it's a great fit for POS devices because, let's face it, POS devices are not gaming machines, and they're not used for doing photo editing and things of that nature. So they don't have a ton of memory on it, and they don't have a ton of CPU on them. So having a lightweight solution on it that offers a great deal of protection is really important so we could give those resources back to those systems so they run properly. If we use some type of blacklisting solution, a lot of times with blacklisting solutions, it's going to take a lot of the memory away from the system and a lot of the CPU. So again, one of the really big benefits of whitelisting or dynamic whitelisting is giving all that performance back to the endpoint and really utilizing minimal amount of resources to make it function with a great deal of protection.
Okay, great. Let's see here. Casey, there's a question relating to my QSA doesn't like the compensating controls that I've designed and implemented. He says it won't fly. Technically, I know I'm right. Any suggestions on what I can do to break this cycle?
Yeah, absolutely. If you've ever been to any of the PCI Security Council's community meetings, there's always kind of that running joke that goes around about if you ask three QSAs one question, you'll get, five or six different answers. Mm-hmm. QSAs, they come from various backgrounds, various areas of technology. Perhaps they've only been, they're transitioning from being an internal auditor into a technology auditor. You kind of get what they come with. The QSA is there to be that third-party opinion as to whether or not they feel that what the merchant is doing fits in with what the requirements are, what the intent of the requirements are. The approval of a compensating control, or really the acceptance of a report on compliance, is all determined by the acquirer. So if a merchant does not agree with the opinion of the QSA, they can talk to their acquirer, make their case. Of course, this is where, documentation and evidence comes in to prove that any risk from, any risk identified is mitigated and the intent of the control is being met with this compensating control.
Okay. Joe, how does whitelisting handle application updates? Can multiple hashes of executables be valid for the same application name?
That's a great question. So as far as updating, we're going to allow updates to take place from a trusted source itself. As far as multiple hashes for applications, so if we actually take one application and we replace it with another application with the same name itself, let's say it's a different size at that point, it actually will dynamically be removed from the whitelist and will be added in with a new version of that hash, as well as the actual executable itself. So it's done, you know, dynamically. Usually the endpoint user will have no idea that this is taking place on the back end itself, but it's a very seamless transition of taking one change coming from a trusted source and making that change on the system itself. So again, really the impact on the user side is nothing, but we, from our perspective, we allow the change to take place, we'll dynamically update the waitlist and allow that application to continue to run on that system.
Okay. Casey, there's a question relating to the regulations do they apply to just brick and mortar point of sale, or are they applicable or extendable to online transaction security and those kinds of things?
So PCI applies to wherever it is that card data is and wherever that card data is accessible by systems on that same network, regardless of the technology that network is comprised of. And regardless of the technology that it sits on, if it's an application, a web application, if it's a code payment module from the acquirer that's embedded into your existing web application, it applies to all of that.
Oh, okay.
And even, you know, mobile devices and things of that nature, it will apply to.
Okay, great. Joe, there's a question about BitLocker. It says the BitLocker runs on the POS system and not the embedded card reader. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay.
So that's more of an encryption type product itself, but yeah, it's more of a it runs on the actual operating system itself.
Okay. And let's see here. Casey, there's a question that asks you to clarify, has the PCI SSC officially ruled that application control is useful as a substitute to AV?
If you look at the council has kind of hidden the frequently asked questions. They're in the top right of their website if you were to go to it, and you can search on compensating control. They have one FAQ, and I don't remember which what number, what date. But basically, the council said that anything that can demonstrate the intent of the requirement is potentially useful.
Joe. Our current software tracks changes for PCI compliance. Can McAfee do that as well?
Absolutely. So one of the benefits of having our EPO server is not only are we going to protect the system for you with our dynamic whitelisting and memory protection, but then we also have the option of doing file integrity monitoring and change management. So any change that takes place on those endpoint systems is going to make its way up to our server itself. So you'll have the who, what, when, where, and how of any change that takes place in that environment.
All right. Casey, can I use the end-of-life operating systems like Windows XP?
That's a great question, and it's a very tricky way to do it. You have two requirements that kind of play a part in whether or not it can be used. First, in requirement 6, which in version 3 now is 6.2, if the system has all applicable patches installed, all applicable security patches, I should clarify, and when you subject the system to vulnerability testing in 11.2, penetration testing in 11.3, if there are no vulnerabilities found, then there's no reason why you cannot use an end-of-life operating system.
Okay. Very good. Unfortunately, that brings us to the conclusion of today's eCast. Thank you very much, Gina, Casey, and Joe, for sharing your expertise and insights on point of sale and credit card transaction security. We at Open Systems Media, McAfee, Foundstone, and Avnet Embedded want to thank you, the audience, for attending today and contributing those excellent questions remotely. Again, don't forget to fill out the closing survey. That is a very important source of feedback for our presenters and the companies they represent. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen within 24 hours. Note that an audio-only podcast will also be made available there. You can do a web search with the keywords embedded space e-cast and find all of Open Systems Media eCasts available for download as MP3s. Thank you all for attending, and have a great day.